Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. One of the most significant and impactful pieces of legislation advancing women's rights was passed just over 50 years ago in June 1972. Title IX clearly opens sports participation opportunities to girls and women, but there are other parts of the sporting landscape that have been slower to catch up. Women are still underrepresented in coaching, sports administration, and sports reporting. Alaska, and in particular Anchorage, was lucky enough to have sports editors in the 1980s who not only gave space on the page to women athletes, but also hired women sports reporters. Enter Beth Bragg, an already seasoned sports reporter from Montana. Now 40 years later, and recently retired as the Anchorage Daily News sports editor, Beth has watched and reported on the evolving landscape of women athletes since Title IX, while still facing the inequities of a career as a woman in a male-dominated field. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Beth.
Howdy.
It's so great turning the tables here. You always used to interview me, and now I'm interviewing you. So I feel like the circle is coming complete.
I think I like it the other way better.
Yeah. Do you feel like I have all this control now and you kind of lost your control?
Yeah. I'm afraid I'll say something really stupid.
Oh, I'm sure you won't. Earlier before we got on, I pulled up, and I could not pull up the statistic for 1985, but I pulled up the statistic of how many sports reporters are women in 2022, and it was 22% of sports reporters are women, and only 15% of sports editors are women. And you've been in the game since the mid 80s.
Actually, since the mid 70s, because I started before I came to Alaska.
Okay, so tell me about how you got into sports reporting.
Okay, I got into it by lying.
We all get good jobs by lying, don't we?
I was a high school senior, 17 years old, in Billings, Montana. And my dad actually worked for the Billings Gazette newspaper. And he had nothing to do with sports. He was a columnist and a feature writer. But he knew that the sports editor every year hired part-timers to work on Friday and Saturday night to take results from football games, basketball games, et cetera. And so the sports editor knew that I was, you know, about 17 years old. So he said, hey, do you think Beth would want to come to work? And my dad said, call her. And so he called me. And I was immediately interested. I had already worked for my high school newspaper and my junior high newspaper and had grown up, you know, playing on the floor of the old Gazette newsroom building with the smell of glue pots and the sound of presses running and, you know, just all the things that I fell in love with, I fell in love with early. And among the things that he asked me was, can you type? And I said, yes. And I couldn't, but my dad.
That's what you lied about, was the typing.
That's what I lied about. But it turned out, A, my dad had plenty of manual typewriters that I was able to practice on. And B, when the first night on the job, I realized that the typing involved was dictation. And it's a lot easier to take dictation than it is to, you know, look over at a piece of paper and input.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's coaches calling you on the phone saying, you know, we won 48-30 and here's who scored the touchdowns. The other thing I learned is that I can write good sentences and that I can write them quickly. And so anything that I gave up in terms of being fast on a typewriter, I made up with for being fast, being able to write 3 or 4 sentences about the game I just took. And so I, you know, from the very first night, I was taking more calls than anyone just because I was fast. And one thing, you know, the guy who hired me and who hired all of those part-timers, he didn't care if you were a man or a woman or if you were a boy or a girl. And to this day, that astonishes me that there was a man in Eastern Montana willing to put a 17-year-old girl on the phone with, you know, coaches who sometimes didn't want to talk to me. I had coaches who would refuse to give me their game scores because I was a woman. And so, you know, luckily he had my back. And I feel really lucky that at every stop along the way, I had sports editors who didn't mind having a woman on the staff. And unfortunately, at every step along the way, I had coaches who did. And so early on, that was particularly something that I dealt with. And, the fact that there are 1 out of 5 women that are sports writers now, 1 out of 5 of all sports writers are women. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was probably not even 1%. And so it really was, you did feel kind of like a pioneer and kind of like you had to do it right and you had to get it right. And we would go out for beers after work, and the drinking age back then was 18. And it would be me and, a bunch of the guys that were sports writers and that were all in their 20s and 30s. And they all had a certain amount of recognition factor. And so guys, other people in the bar would come up and say, "Hey, how about that game tonight?" And I was the only one who would sit at that table and who people who'd come up to talk to us would get quizzed. Who won the 1964 World Series? What was the single game rushing record for Montana? None of the guys sitting there got quizzed. I always got quizzed. Mm-hmm. So Title IX had nothing to do with sports writing, but it had everything to do with making girls and women an accepted part of the landscape. Mm-hmm. And as the years went on, the resistance went away. I never really have been part of a staff that had a lot of women on it, but I would go to the Olympics and there would be scores of women there, and it would be like, oh my God, how exciting, there's women here. and I think that you look at ESPN now and almost every sideline reporter is a woman. Mm-hmm. And you listen to the radio and there's a lot of women that have radio shows on ESPN and on other sports networks. And that's, I don't think that happens without Title IX.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that both more women in journalism and men who were willing to report on women had a lot to do with the acceptance of women in sports?
I think so. I think, and not all newspapers that I worked for, but certainly the Daily News made a real concerted effort to have some equity in coverage. We weren't going to double team, which means send two reporters, we weren't going to double team a UAA volleyball game that maybe had 400 people, whereas we would double team a UAA hockey game that had 6,000 people. So sometimes you're still making those choices based on general population preferences.
Right.
But we would still have somebody at that volleyball match, and mm-hmm. that volleyball match would often make our front page. It would often be photographed and would be the lead photo in the next day's paper. And I think that Lou Friedman and Roger Brigham, who came before me, helped set that tone. And then I think I kind of very eagerly picked it up and maybe advanced it a little farther, but I think Lou and Roger both had that sense that women's sports deserve to be there. And I think, once you see those women bylines and women reporters on the sidelines, and then start seeing the headlines about, Diamond High flag football team wins 7th in a row, that helps the acceptance. And mm-hmm. it helps make it be not the novelty anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And girls' sports were definitely a novelty when I was growing up.
In the 70s, I was here. I was a little girl. Mm-hmm. Not a little girl. Yeah, I was a little girl in the 60s. But but the only woman I remember really consistently being covered in the newspaper, of course, we all knew Betsy Haynes. She was a hero to us. But you didn't see much coverage of her in the newspaper. And on the TV, but who I remember was Roxy Wright. Mm-hmm. Like, she was my hero mm-hmm. growing up. I mean, she was a woman competing against men, and she always seemed to get a lot of coverage.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's look at where you live.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Look at the crowds that, especially back then, the crowds that Ferrande got, and,
yep.
and the fact that she was world-class athlete winning world-class events.
Mm-hmm. And for me,
that still doesn't justify that we weren't writing about Betsy.
Yeah, I know. Betsy, she was, being an East High graduate, of course, and she went to East High, she was like a legend at East High.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we all wanted to be Betsy.
Going through old photos that we had, just file photos, and we had a photo of her at her Olympics where she was at the very front of the field for the start, you know? And so like for 30 seconds or how, I don't know, she would be able to tell you more, but
yeah.
for a few seconds, she was leading the race and I think she had braids on and she looked like an 18-year-old, and it was just, you know, that was Betsy Haynes to me. It was just,
yeah. Oh, that's great. It was really, I think, important for me. And I think this is maybe not even an issue anymore, to see Roxy Wright, to see a woman doing what she loved to do in sports. And that was like super inspiring to me as a little girl, to see that person who's like you in that position.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know any women who covered sports when I started. You know who there was? And I'm smiling kind of snarkily right now, and I don't mean to, but you know who there was when I started? Ooh. Phyllis George. Miss America. And she was like I think she was Monday Night Football kind of sideline. And she would play the piano before she would do a story, you know, and it was like, that's how you got a job back then, was by being Miss America.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But at least she was doing it, and at least she was there, and at least she educated herself to know what she was talking about.
Wasn't there the controversy in the 80s when women started going into locker rooms?
Yeah.
Tell a little bit about that.
She was with the Boston Globe and she went into a Patriots locker room and they all just treated her like trash and they demeaned her and they, you know, basically punished her. And that was a big deal. That was right before I came up here, I think. And maybe it was still ongoing when I got here. And I was, you know, I think lucky enough where I didn't deal with that issue that much, because I was covering high school and Division II college sports, where if you wanted, no reporter's going into a girls' high school locker room, you know.
Right.
And
yeah.
I kind of think that, and I guess, you know, you get to the NFL level and those levels, and you probably have to be in those locker rooms to get access. Mm-hmm. But I kind of think that the locker room should belong to the athletes, whether you're a male reporter or a female reporter. And so
I was in an environment where that
was okay to say, hey, I want to talk to so-and-so. Can you send him out before he showers?
Have they changed that now? I mean, do reporters still, I don't watch the big sports like that, but do reporters still go into locker rooms?
Yeah, they still do.
Do they?
Yeah.
And obviously women have to be allowed to go into the locker rooms if they're reporting.
Yeah, and I've gone in, you know, certainly during the shootout, especially at the peak of the shootout, of the Great Alaska Shootout basketball tournament, when national media was here en masse, I had to go into the locker rooms, because if I didn't, I wouldn't get those interviews, because, you know, whoever, Glenn Rice is here, and everybody wants to talk to him, and he's only going to do the one interview. He's not going to do the locker room interview with all the national media and then come out into the hallway so the woman from the local newspaper can ask him the same questions. so there were times when I did go into the locker room, and even with UAA basketball, I did that sometimes, and I didn't feel real comfortable, and I don't think they felt really comfortable. And I was really content, even with the Anchorage Times in town when there was competition, I felt like I could get as good an interview 10 minutes later as I could if I was in the locker room.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in some ways a more honest interview.
Yeah.
Because emotions have calmed down a little bit from the game and everything. So you were in Billings. So were you in Billings at like about that 10 years and then you came up to Alaska? How did you get to Alaska?
I was at three newspapers in Montana. I was part-time at the Gazette, and then I was hired full-time at the Bozeman Chronicle, home of the Bobcats.
Lots of Montana people here. So
yes, I used to hear poor Bobcats all the time when I go into Darwin's Theory after the Montana State Montana game in October. And then I worked for the Great Falls Tribune before I came up here.
Have we talked about that before? Because I told you that my dad grew up in Great Falls. My dad's family's in Great Falls.
I don't know if we did talk about that.
Yeah. So in my, during that time, my grandparents would have still been living in Great Falls. Wow. Yeah.
Great Falls was a little, I felt a little less accepted in Great Falls than in other places. Mm-hmm. And I think it might've been, it was a little bit older population. Mm-hmm. And of all the departments I've worked for, or the newspapers I've worked for, that was the one where I felt I was kind of pigeonholed because I was a woman. I was always having to, I shouldn't say having, but I was always assigned to cover the girls' games.
Mm-hmm.
And at no other place did I kind of feel like that type of a pigeonhole.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, at some point I kind of embraced covering women more than men, you know, because for one thing, a lot of times I was the only one covering those teams. And so you had a different kind of access. When yours is the only face they've seen, you get different stories. And so I came to kind of embrace covering those teams. And then, you know, then you've got the UA women's basketball team turns into one of the best in the country, and I'm already there. Same thing with volleyball, same thing with skiing, those kind of sports where there may be not a huge concentration of reporters, but good things happening, and you get that story.
And you were also here at kind of the beginning of women-only sporting events, like originally the women's run. I mean, it was already going by the time you got here, but then
I was here for the breakup.
Right, the breakup, exactly, which was quite exciting and, you know, became such a much better event too, you know.
Yeah, and I think that. I got here for the third year of the triathlon when mm-hmm. I got here. And I was already here when the Ski for Women started. In fact, I was the one that told Sally and I think it was Anne Mize who mm-hmm. started it. And I said, did you guys know that you scheduled this on the Super Bowl? And it turned out to be terrific planning, even though it was unplanned, you know.
Yeah, they didn't even plan that. That's one of the myths of it, isn't it, that it was planned for Super Bowl Sunday? Because I think there is also a myth, I think this is a myth, that there's more domestic violence cases on that day, but that's actually an urban legend or something.
Correct.
And then of course the Bike for Women. Uh-huh. And now there's the Mountain Bike for Women. So have you ever, or do you know of a community that's ever had so many women's events?
No. Why do you think that is?
We have so many women's events.
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I think that my first thought is that Alaska is just a different place, and that
yes, it is.
It's kind of if you show yourself to be capable and competent, you're going to thrive. Mm-hmm. And I think that. I think we had some really important pioneers. You know, you look at Marcy Trent,
who
started running, I think, when she was 50, but it was like about 1960 when she did that. And she kind of brought so many women into the running community, and not everybody has a Marcy Trent, and not everybody has a Betsy Haynes. Mm-hmm. And I think that we had, you know, Judy Rabinowitz.
Oh, right. Yep.
And getting a little closer into the 80s, Libby and Susan. Mm-hmm. In the Iditarod, right. You know.
Yep.
So
Chris Thorsness. I have to throw out Chris Thorsness. That was huge. The first gold medalist.
I missed that one by a year, I think, or 2 years. And that's one of my regrets, is that I wasn't in Anchorage in time for those 1984 Olympics when she and Don Clary.
Were
doing their great things. But you know, Chris has been. You should talk to Chris. You know, she would probably have some incredible insight about Title IX and
oh yeah. I did have her on my list to talk to, yeah.
according to her Facebook page, she's been in Europe for the last last week or so.
I am trying to get this all put together before the end of the year, but I kind of feel, because this is the 50th anniversary, but I kind of feel like I'm not going to be able to put it all together by the end of the year, because I think it's going to be a series of shows, really.
Well, think of seasons. You know, you're doing it in the 1922-23 school year.
And that's true. Yeah, I like that. I like that.
You know, I remember when I was still back in Montana, I was there. It was right before I moved up here. So it was like 1984 And they were still having problems implementing it. You know, the law went into effect in 72. You were supposed to be compliant by 75. 10 years later, most of the country still isn't compliant. And I covered meetings of the Montana High School Association, which is their version of ASA. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to like a their annual meeting that had all of the school administrators, all of the athletic directors from every high school in Montana. And Title IX was the big conversation. And athletic director and principal, after, you know, just one right after the other, got up and said, "We don't have the facilities to have another varsity team, much less a JV team, much less a C team. We don't have the people who can run a clock for a second game every Friday night. We don't have the referees. We don't have the money for uniforms. We don't have the buses." And it was just one right after the other. And it was all, "We can't, we can't, we can't." Mm-hmm. And for many years, Montana put the high school girls basketball season in the fall because they refused, kind of administrators refused to let it run concurrently with the boys season because they didn't want the boys to have to compete for gym time.
Wow.
And for those other things. And it took a lawsuit to finally get it reversed. You know, they had volleyball in the winter and basketball in the fall. And so finally, after many years and a lawsuit, that got changed. And it seems like in Alaska, at least some schools were more willing to figure it out. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody like Kenny Sailors, who was up here in the 60s running girls basketball programs before Title IX said they had to. So there was kind of some awareness. I don't think there were any basketball programs in Montana before Title IX said there had to be. And again, what made that happen in Alaska, I'm not quite sure, but I think it's kind of the spirit of the people and the individuality and the fact that we're going to, you know, if we can figure out a way to make it work, we're going to figure out a way to make it work. And they did figure out ways to make those seasons run concurrently. Did they do it fairly all the time? No, they didn't. You know, the Anchorage School District for several years back in the 90s tried to count cheerleaders as athletes in order to make their Title IX numbers add up. And I don't begrudge competitive cheerleaders being counted, but they were counting sideline cheerleaders.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no season, they had no competition. And the Department of Justice is pretty clear that if it's going to be a sport, they have to have regularly scheduled competitions, regularly scheduled practices, the whole thing. And sideline cheerleading, it just didn't happen. And that, again, it took a lawsuit to take care of that. And guess what that spawned?
Flag football.
Exactly. what's the most popular sport other than football in terms of participation in the city of Anchorage?
Flag football. Yeah.
You know, and so Title IX still works. That granted was, you know, Kathleen probably remembers better than me, but I want to say early 2000s that mm-hmm. happened. So
when I was talking to Kathleen, I said, I think one of the most significant things about flag football were the pictures that were generated from flag football, because you can see their faces, which is different than football. You can't see their faces and you can't see their bodies. And you could see these highly competitive, skilled athletes. And I thought the pictures just sold that sport and sold women's sports. It was amazing to me to see
the
pictures.
That's a great point. That's a great point, because it did photograph differently than almost any other girls' sport.
Yep.
You know, it was that contact. It was that, you know, they were wearing mouthpieces, which always makes you look fierce.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And you could see kind of the ruggedness, you know, that it wasn't, "Oh, we're playing powder puff football."
Right.
You know,
which was what happened with us in high school. You probably powder puff football. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a great point, because those photos really did show that they were girls, mm-hmm. show that they were athletes, mm-hmm. show that they were competing.
Yep. On the college level, now that we have about 60% of college, you know, generalized over all colleges, 60% of undergraduates are now women.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that, or do you think it already has started to reflect Title IX? Because if you're talking just about the amount of money spent and the mm-hmm. number of athletes in your sports, that says your college should have 60% of their right. money in their sports going to
and
women.
They don't. And they don't. And you know, what people say, and I think to a certain degree is true, is that what really tips the scales to put more, a bigger percentage of men in the game is the numbers that are required for a football team.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I think it's like, I think that a Division I football team has more than 100 players on the roster.
Is that, I've seen that number too. Yep.
Yeah. You know, and that right there, there's no women's sport that mm-hmm. compares to that.
Right.
And if you kind of throw out football, then those numbers get participation wise, they get mm-hmm. more even. Financially, football, you know, puts a big thumb on the
yes.
scale. And that's, you know, I don't know. I think there's been progress made in some respects, but then you look at not this year, but last year at the NCAA basketball tournament, where the player from Oregon posted the
right.
photo of their weight room that included a stack of dead weights, and that was it.
Yep.
And the men had acres and acres of you know, dead weights and free weights, and it just
yeah. And their swag bag was just such a difference between what they were getting on their greeting package and everything. I mean,
yeah,
it was just shocking, really, in 2022 that was happening.
It really was. Yeah, I remember back when the old Northern Lights Invitational, mm-hmm. the basketball tournament that was the women's version of the shootout, and that used to be an 8-team tournament. It was all Division I except for UAA, just like the men's tournament. And they brought in some big name teams. They brought in Pat Summitt. They brought
right.
in Cheryl Miller. They brought in, you know, some real legit, I think the only team they never got was UConn. I don't mm-hmm. think UConn ever came, but you know, all the other programs were up here. And those were, you know, those were teams that had been to the NCAA, that had been to the White House, that had been to places, and they would come here and they would marvel that they would get swag, that
yeah.
you know, that they would go to the banquet and they would get I think the winners a couple of years got rings, you know, they got trophies that were as big as the men's trophies. They got, you know, they just got perks. They got you know, they didn't get great locker rooms.
Yeah.
No one did. It was just all of the arena. Or actually it was UAA for the women, but they would comment on that. Coaches, Division I women's coaches would say, we don't get treated like this at home.
Wow.
You know, so that was always kind of a cool thing to hear, but also a sad thing to hear. That,
yeah.
You know, that the shootout men's teams would come up here and they're like, oh, we just get a watch. That's all.
Yeah.
And the women would be like, oh my God, we got a watch.
That is amazing.
and then kind of to show how Title IX is still a breathing important thing that you have to watchdog. Eventually they got rid of the Northern Lights Invitational and they turned it into a 4-team tournament played at the same time as the men's tournament. So, and like they pitched it as, but they get to play at Sullivan, but they got to play at Sullivan at 9 a.m. And it was only
yeah.
a 4-team tournament. It wasn't an 8-team tournament. And I remember we wrote stories about how this should put UAA in Title IX jeopardy.
Yeah.
Because they've really taken this prize tournament or event and watered it down. And mm-hmm. and actually, I think there was a year without the tournament when they just killed it and then brought it back. I think they thought, oops,
yeah,
we need to do this for compliance. And I'm talking, you know, I'm talking for UAA now, and I shouldn't, I don't know. But my memory is that it got cut for financial reasons and came back because I think they realized that for equity, maybe not for legal equity, but just for equity of to feel good about their own house, that they reinstated a women's tournament. And
well,
now now there's only a women's shootout this year.
Oh, see, I didn't even know that because I wasn't paying attention, but that is amazing. There's only a women's shootout, huh?
Yeah, you know, they got rid of the shootout, I think, in 2017. And then this year, for the first time, they're going to bring 3 Division I teams in for a 4-team women's tournament.
Wow. Mm.
Which is pretty cool. And I, you know, I think that's somebody like that Ryan McCarthy probably pushed for and was able to make happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I think Ryan's a really interesting situation, you know, in kind of a Title IX baby. You know, not that he's a baby, but a product of Title IX is he played men's basketball, and I think he came out wanting to be a men's coach. Wound up taking this job because he was young and it was offered to him, and at that point it was his best entry into the world of being a head coach. And I would be surprised if he ever coached men again at this
wow.
point. You know, I think that he, you know, sees the potential of coaching women and leading women to championships and making a name in a women's sport. And mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting that he probably, when he was, you know, 20 years old, looked at himself as being a men's coach. And now he's probably looking at, I could retire as a women's coach and mm-hmm. be and retire very happily and very successfully.
Well, that's cool. Also kind of still an area, kind of talking about the financial piece of this, you know, that lots of times sports are cut because the people aren't showing up to watch, you know,
right,
that's the excuse of it. And you look at him and you, oftentimes you're not paid as much as the men's coach. You get paid less mm-hmm. as a woman's uh-huh. coach.
You're still working the same hours.
Yeah, exactly. So there's still that inequity there that doesn't help promote women's sports.
Right.
But I think, do you feel like often that this financial piece of it is used as an excuse, but then we look at the women's national soccer team, you know, who obviously is a much bigger draw than the men's team. And they've had to work for years.
They just got it. Yeah.
And they just got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've been working for years to get this equity.
Right. And I think that continues to be a public perception issue, is that the men fill the stadiums, the men get, you know, people want to watch it on TV. Therefore we can justify the higher salaries and the better facilities and things like that. But I think we've also seen that if you put a good product out there, whether it's men or women, people will watch it. I think the women's soccer team showed us that. I think the 1996 Olympics showed us that with women's softball. And, you know, that was kind of the Title IX Olympics. I think a lot of people
looked
at it that. It was 96, that was 22 years after the implementation. And here we are, we're seeing what it brought.
And that was a famous moment of Brandi Chastain ripping off her jersey. And that was.
And Dot Richardson,
Dot Richardson. Yeah, the softball player. The
softball player. And it seems like there's another team sport that was maybe beach volleyball. I don't think that was new, but again, just all those women team sports kind of bam, here we are. And then, and they're still inequities for sure, but those teams haven't gone away. And mm-hmm. even though they got rid of softball at the Olympic level, there's still a robust college softball program. And I think we'll see it back at the Olympics at some point.
We are going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll hear more from Beth Bragg, retired Anchorage Daily News sports editor. This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. And I'm your host, Lisa Keller.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest is Beth Bragg, retired Anchorage Daily News sports editor. And when we're talking about the Olympics too, it more in, I think maybe both the winter and the summer past Olympics, there have been more medals from American women than American mm-hmm. men.
Yeah.
So those are becoming the superstars, the American women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's wonderful to see. And they finally can compete in the same events. I mean, when I talk to younger athletes, and when I say younger, sometimes I mean you.
Yeah. I'm not that much younger than you. But
maybe somebody like Ethan, you know, maybe someone in their 30s, which isn't young. I mean, it is young, but it's somebody who's seasoned. Mm-hmm. And they're still kind of blown away when you tell them, you know, the women weren't allowed to run the marathon at the Olympics until 1984.
Joan Benoit Samuelson. Yep.
You know, and wrestling, you know, you mentioned the woman in Kodiak who's having the
Chloe
wrestling.
Chloe Ivanov. Yep.
Wrestling didn't become an Olympic sport for women until, and I'm going to get this wrong, but I want to say Sydney in 2000. And there were two Alaskans on that team. Alaska, again, that's a place where Alaska was ahead of the curve, was girls wrestling. And that was a lot of rural Alaska, you know, the Kotzebues, the Bethels, where maybe because the winters are long, maybe because, you know, the schools are open, wrestling has had a fairly firm footprint in rural Alaska for many years. You know, Michaela Hutchinson becoming the first girl in the country to win a state championship against the boys. And that's because she had been doing it for years and years and years. And why Alaska? Why did we have more wrestlers? Why do we have more wrestlers? I don't know. Maybe it's just because we don't put as many limits. You know, it's like, if you want to do it and you can find somebody to roll out a mat for you, go ahead and do it. If you want to get together six dogs and feed them and take care of them, you can run the junior for Ronde, and someday you can be Roxy Wright, you know. It just might be a place where opportunities are extended and made possible. You know, I don't know that answer, but it seems like, you know, you see it in a lot of places in Alaska, where the first all women's triathlon, the biggest all women's fill in the blank,
I think maybe talking this out kind of makes me think that a lot of this has to do is we've had a lot of women who have also had breakout performances in against men, competing against men. Yeah. You know, Roxy Wright becomes not only the oldest, but the first woman to win the world sprint championships, the Ferrandi. You know, at 66, she wins it. And it was, I went out, I walked over there to watch her from my house, and I'm just like, oh, my hero, she's winning this. And she's this little tiny woman, you know, it was just crazy to watch.
And then you've got Libby, who's the only one willing to leave that checkpoint in the teeth of a raging storm. And you've got Susan, who, you know, dials in the whole, everything that you need to be an efficient musher, she dialed in on that.
Yep. And Michaela Hutchinson in wrestling.
Yeah.
Allie Ostrander winning the junior race outright against the boys and girls.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that Lydia Jacoby has had faster breaststroke times than any boys.
That's probably true. Yeah.
So, and you know, Nancy Pease,
yeah.
Winning Crow Pass with Bill Spencer, you know?
Yeah.
And crushing most of the men on most of the mountains. So there really has been, long ago and even now, women who perform in those kind of arenas where they get to compete against the men. Mm-hmm. And even where they don't, they're doing badass stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, they're doing badass. They're as big a badass as Harlow is, or as
right,
you know, or as Brent Sass, I think that'd be a great subject. Is like, why are there so many badasses in Alaska sports?
I know it is pretty shocking that there are so many badass women in Alaska.
Yeah, if you look at that website that Joe Stock keeps for the Chugach Front Range, how many women have done it solo? How many women have done it in 24 hours? How many women have done it? Period. I mean, it's It's an impressive.
Sophie Tidler was the first one to do it on winter solstice.
Yeah.
She did it solo. First one to do it solo, yeah. But also then she was the first person to do it on winter solstice.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, again, and this is, we're getting away from Title IX, but look at the Seven Summits woman, and I'm forgetting her name right now.
Dolly Lefevre.
and she did, that was a national accomplishment. That was an international accomplishment. Yeah. And she just was this quiet person from here who, she didn't do it with fanfare. She just did it.
Right. Another little tiny woman. She's not a big woman, you know, she's just a little tiny woman.
Yeah. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. And I think that's pretty damn impressive and important going forward.
If you are just joining us, you are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest today is Beth Bragg, retired Anchorage Daily News sports editor.
When I was in Bozeman, my roommate worked for State Farm, and the claims adjuster in her office was a guy who had played football for Montana State. And I was probably 22, 23 years old at that point. Mm-hmm. And he was a couple years older. He had already graduated from MSU and was probably about 28 years old. And my roommate and I were part of a fantasy football league that he was also in. And so every once in a while on Monday night, he'd come over and have a beer with us. And he told me, he knew my roommate and then found out who I was. And he told me that he had like two little girls that were like, you know, a baby and a toddler. And he was outraged that I was a sports writer. You know, he said, well, you can't cover football. And I said, why can't I cover football? He said, because you've never played football. You don't know what it's like in that locker room. You don't know what it's like in the trenches. And besides, you just have no business being there. He said, if either of my girls ever became a sports writer, I would disown them.
Oh my gosh. That's pretty huge.
I mean. And it was, I mean, staggering.
There's lots of things I would never disown my kids, but there's lots of like things that you might disown them over that like if they murdered somebody or they murdered your other kid or something, maybe, but exactly.
I was astonished when he said that. I was just gobsmacked when he said that, and he was as serious as a heart attack. He meant
so. What became of those little girls? Because those little girls would be younger than me.
Yeah, I've often wondered that. Once I left Bozeman, I never saw him again. And I can't even remember what his name, I could probably go back and look at old Montana State football rosters and that's what it was. But, you know, part of me hopes that one of them's an ESPN sideline reporter.
Exactly. And he's probably totally into them now.
His grandchildren are probably, you know, playing flag football or basketball or
exactly
whatever.
Obviously there are lots of just kids that don't play sports, but that is kind of a pinnacle thing for a lot of people is your kids play sports, whether they're boys or girls. There's no difference. Don't differentiate anymore, you know.
So I was in Bozeman from 1980 to 83, so that happened in the early 80s. That mentality was still there, and he was a college graduate and he still thought that way. I got that a lot, you know.
Yeah, I bet you did. I was pretty like shocked when I went and saw the statistics now for the sports reporters and sports editors, because I'm like, oh god, it had to be like you saw nobody who was like you.
no, not at all.
It was George.
certainly not that were, you know, there, because that sports editor who was the first one to hire me, because he had all these little, you know, he had like his crew of part-timers, and we were all 17, 18 years old. And so there were a couple of boys and a couple of girls. And so there, at least at that point, there were other girls, but at no level did I ever belong to a department that had another full-time sports writer who was a woman. Mm-hmm. We had a couple clerks here at the Daily News, but they never advanced to being a writer. Great Falls, I don't think we had any. And in Bozeman, it was a two-person staff, and it was me and the guy. So it really wasn't until I went to my first Olympics that I really experienced being around other women who were covering sports.
And were most of those women from, I would assume like immediately, I think from the Scandinavian countries, but maybe well, not, were, I don't know.
There were a lot of international, but there were a lot of American reporters okay. and a lot of them were from big newspapers, you know, the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe and the Chicago Tribune, all of which had at that time dedicated Olympic reporters. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Olympic beat reporters were women.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
And I know, and maybe it's because that was one of the places where women also competed, but for whatever reason, a lot of women were part of the Olympic beats at their newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where was it? It was in Albertville in 92, which is when Russia competed under the Olympic, the IOC, because the Soviet Union was breaking up and they didn't really have a country. And I was going out, God, talk about being the lone wolf, covering biathlon at any Olympics. You're always the only American there. Except for in Salt Lake City. There are a lot of American reporters at the biathlon there. But I was going to a biathlon race in 92. And I was on a busload of reporters, probably 50 of us. And I think there was like maybe two that spoke English besides me.
Oh, wow.
They were all Eastern European, especially because that's, you know, Russia, big biathlon and a lot of Scandinavians. And I was sitting next to a woman who was from Germany, which had finally been unified, but she had been from East Germany and she spoke some English. And so we were talking a little bit and she spent much of our hour and a half bus ride, which was like the story of Albertville, you were always on a bus, lamenting how horrible things had gotten for athletics after the Berlin Wall fell.
Really?
Because East Germany had had that sports machine and they won everything. And then the wall fell and they were unified and they didn't have that state-sponsored sports machine anymore. And
so yeah, Germany, sure.
You know, I mean, remember East Germany used to just clean up in
right. So you mean
sports.
They went to the West and they couldn't dope anymore for a exactly. while until they figured a way around it there.
Exactly. So. They couldn't yeah. dope. They didn't have that state supported yep. machine. And mm-hmm. I was just astonished to hear her talk about how wistful she was for the days of East Germany.
Well, see, she had a good life in East Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, so that
even though wasn't it always dark in East Germany, and as soon as you went over the wall, it was light and the sun was out.
They didn't have the Beatles, they didn't have right. blue jeans.
Exactly. Gosh, you've seen a lot just going through all these Olympics. You know, so much change in the different countries with the Olympics.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of it involved kind of the introduction of sports for women. You know, from wrestling to I wasn't part of the marathon, but there were events. I don't think they had a 30K race for women
mm-hmm.
until fairly recently. And, you know, just things like that, you know, disparities that still, like, why don't the women ski a 50K?
That's still the discrepancy at the high school level. I think it's the last one, isn't it? Like, girls play with the same size. Do they play with the same size basketball?
No, they have a smaller ball.
Which kind of makes sense because hands are smaller.
I can understand that
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
But there are some distance differences.
Yeah, like I think the high school, the girls ski 5K and the boys ski 7.5.
Yeah. And the same thing with college cross country, I think. That the girls or the women run shorter distances than the men still, which I don't understand.
It makes no sense at all for that to still be happening.
And why is pro tennis 5 sets for men and 3 sets for women?
Yeah.
And, you know, because I think most women would say, yeah, let us play 5.
Yeah,
know?
I think so.
Let us die out there too. and there's still, you know, there's still no, they finally brought pole vault in for women at the Olympics. I don't think they do the hammer throw though for women.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still some that, like figure skating, the men for the long program skate for 4.5 minutes and the women skate for 4.
Oh, and 30 seconds difference.
Yeah. And I don't know. I would like to see 30 more seconds of Michelle Kwan or, you know, of a woman skater. So there are little weird things that remain different because you're girls and women and you're not, you can't do it for as long, or you aren't strong enough to do 50K or something. And, you know, maybe the Keegans of the world are glad they don't have to go. But, you know, they all go that same distance in the Tour of Anchorage.
Right. Exactly.
And you know, some of the APU women are right there at the front of it, you know, just like the APU men are.
It's just like women still not making as much money as men for the same job.
Yeah.
So as long as those inequities are happening anywhere, they're going to happen in other places too, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, and I was always paid less than any other editor at the Daily News.
Were you really? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow.
And in fact, for a while we had MBOs for section editors, which are management by objective bonuses. And, you know, if you do X, Y, and Z, then you get X percent of your salary as a bonus. And I didn't get that bonus until I had been in the job for about 7 years.
Wow.
And the features editor had it, the copy desk chief had it, the photo editor had it, all the other people had it, but they didn't give it to sports. And to be fair, Lou didn't get it either before, you know, he was the editor before I was. They just kind of didn't think sports should get it for some reason.
Wait, there's a whole section that's sports. I mean, that's a whole section of the paper, like back in the day.
I managed more people than the photo editor did, or than the features editor did, or some of the other editors. So that wasn't as much male female. It was more kind of disrespecting sports. But certainly my salary was not the same as the men's. And I you know, I should have, could have, would have done something about it, but I didn't. You know, that's the problem with journalism, is the culture of newspapers, I should say, not of journalism, but of newspapers, and that you're made to feel like you're lucky to have the job. And that, you know, if you don't like it, you can go work PR. And they know that that's not what we want to do. They know that we want to cover the news and cover the stories and write the stories. We don't want to write press releases. But that's what I've had more than one editor say, you know, well, if you're not happy with your salary, we can find somebody else and you can find another job.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Which is really sad.
That is super sad. I mean, I don't think they can do that anymore, or getting to the point where they can't do things like that anymore, because they won't have anybody working for them. So one last question. What does Title IX mean to you?
It means to me a repainted landscape. It means that when you go to a gym, you're going to see as many girls there as you are boys. It means when you go to Tuesday night race series, you're going to get chicked. You know, it to me, when I was in high school, we had golf and tennis, which were both country club sports. We had gymnastics. We had track and we had cross country, and that was it for girls. That was it. No basketball, no volleyball, no real team sport.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
And now, gosh, you look at what you've got here and at many other schools, and girls have their choice of 5 sports every semester or more versus 5 sports for the whole school year. And then that just means it looks different. It looks more diverse. It looks like it should look. And it looks, you know, and the fact that it took a federal law to make that happen, I think is sad. But I thank God for Title IX, because it's still doing its job. And, you know, just this week, I think Brown University got dinged with $1 million worth of lawyer fees for trying to turn a bunch of women's sports into club sports. And they got sued and yada, 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 you know? So, so I think it's a living, breathing law that, that has changed. God, you know, I think it's changed even women who aren't athletes, even women who aren't sports writers. It has changed their world in ways that they might not know until, unless they go back and look at what the world was like in 1970, where the images of men and women were so different. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, women can do and be whatever they want. And I think whether that's in sports or theater or politics or science or academia, I think Title IX's made a difference there. Mm-hmm.
It truly has kind of bled into all pieces of our society.
You know, and it is an academic, you know, it's
right.
And I think, I don't think that the athletic angle of it was an unintended consequence. I think that created the sea change, but now you're seeing Title IX coming into play when it comes to sexual assault, and sexual harassment, and other areas that are just, if not more important, in academics, it applies. You know, you have to have certain things that are available for women if they're available for men. And I don't think you can say enough about what difference it has made, and take that out of the field of sports. It's made such a difference.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today, Beth. This was just, like I said, I could talk to you forever. So I might revisit you.
Well, if you have any other questions, let me know and feel free to cut and paste as you need.
Okay. Thank you. And you know what?
I don't use all of my notes when I take notes.
Yeah, exactly. You get a whole bunch and then you got to whittle it down.
I talked to 15 kids at a state cross country meet. And then you're like, oh, how do I get all 15 of them into this 20-inch story?
Yeah, I know. That's the heartbreaking piece of it. You have to cut away some of your children, don't you?
Yep. Kill your little darlings, they call it.
Yeah. That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Beth Bragg. Before we leave today, we would like to offer our condolences to the family of Ann Mize, the co-founder of the Alaska Ski for Women, who passed away on January 20th. Ann was born and raised in Anchorage and lived an active lifestyle her entire life. In the 1960s, when women's enrollment in higher education lagged far behind men's enrollment, Ann graduated from the University of Colorado with a degree in physical education. She immediately began her career as a physical education teacher. She taught at Diamond Mears Junior Senior High School and coached several sports, including cross-country skiing, cross-country running, tennis, and badminton. She continued coaching cross-country skiing with the Alaska Pacific University Women's Master's Program after she retired from ASD. She also continued competing herself, winning 3 gold medals at the 2004 World Masters Championships in Lillehammer, Norway. Her legacy as a pioneering coach and as an event creator who expanded opportunities for girls and women will live on forever. The show was produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.